If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, and it's another special.
Woo!
Today's guest is Philip Mould, OBE. We're having a conversation with him all about art. It was only on the last podcast that I was struggling with the idea of art.
Of course you were, yes.
And what art is. And actually, Philip answers some of my questions.
That was actually from one of my random words as well.
Yes, it was.
How weird.
So if you don't know who Philip Mould is, you should. He's so lovely. I actually really love listening to him talk. He's so eloquent, isn't he? So he's an art collector, an art dealer, and an art sleuth.
Presenter?
Yeah, presenter stroke sleuth. Sleuth. So what he does
he's certainly not a fake, is he? He's the real deal.
And he's got his own podcast, which we discussed. That's very good, Mark. Yes, I noticed that. He's written a lot of books. He's written The Amazing Quest for the Lost Art Treasure. He's a real-life Indiana Jones. That's what he is. He doesn't come with the hat, though. And he's also written a book called Sleepers in Search of Lost Old Masters. He's also... on that show Fake or Fortune, which is where him and Fiona Bruce, they take a piece of art and then they decide whether it is a fake or a fortune. 5 million people are tuning into that. They don't decide, they get experts to decide. But he just basically does a whole conversation all about art and
very what good, he feels very about. Interesting, very knowledgeable.
Yeah,
as you expect.
Are you knowledgeable
to be.
About art? Because I'm not at all.
No, me, no. Oh no, I know nothing.
Yeah, nor do I. I was well out of my depth having this conversation.
Got a C at GCSE and a D at A level.
Okay. Oh, you took art for A level.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
That was a misstep, I think. Looking back,
did you have to do
oil painting? I did.
Did you have to do the history of it and all that
yes,
stuff? Yes,
yeah, well? you did that as well.
That's good. So he discusses everything from what he thinks of Banksy and all the modern artists through to the old classics. And he also does this podcast that I just briefly mentioned there about a discovery he's made very recently. Literally this week they announced it in the papers. He discovered a old portrait of Charles Dickens and the backstory, and that's great. And it's... kind of involves lots of politics as well in that, which is good, and it sort of made me understand a bit more about why art is so important. Charles Dickens very big on social reform and all those sort of things. Anyway, this is it. This is the podcast. Let's meet him, Philip Mould.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy, and if it does, right into Dear Lovejoy.
Welcome to my kitchen, Philip, and welcome to Cedric, who's also come, your lovely Whippet, Greyhound, Whippet.
Whippet.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Lovely dog. First things first, I must always buy my guests a present, so I bought you a nice bottle of red wine. I assume you like red wine.
I do.
Good.
Do you know, I've recently given up drinking.
Oh, no.
But to be able to give wine is just as much a pleasure. Actually, it's not. as drinking it. So I'm very touched. I need all the wine I can get.
Okay.
I need all the friends I can get.
You can re-gift it. I'll allow you to do that. I assume if you're into art, you also like all the classics, and including red wine.
Yeah, but I can't really talk about it. Like people can when they're really good at wine,
right?
I mean, I can come up with the old art adjectives, but wine's tricky, isn't it?
Well, I find that there's people get angry with me for this, but I really like wine. I really like art. I really like classical music. I like ballet and things like that. But I don't really want to learn about it. There's just too much to learn. Mm. And what I quite like is experts telling me instead. Mm. So, and that especially goes with wine, but also art. So let's talk about art today. I'll probably ask you some questions which are really stupid because I don't know a lot. However, I do like it. First thing we've got to talk about is a great week for you with your Dickens portrait discovery. Mm. You do an amazing podcast. I've listened to it, and it's a... it's an absolute delight, especially at this time of year for Christmas. Mm. I learned so much. For anyone who doesn't know what's happened, because you've hit all the press this week with it, what have you found?
We found, and it came from, of all places, South Africa, the lost portrait of our beloved Charles Dickens, just as he was writing The Christmas Carol, or A Christmas Carol, as it's called. And it is a picture that hasn't been seen in public. Sorry, as I'm talking, my whippet is dropping a ball in front of me. He can't bear not being the centre of attention.
He's found a tennis ball to get him running around. I don't know if we...
He's our gallery dog. He's seen more art than any dog you care to mention.
Amazing.
If his tennis ball is annoying you, let me know. But unfortunately, I can't do anything to stop him. So we're all in the gallery. I'll tell you how it began, because it is epic, actually. Yeah. For me, this is a real big one in our lives, in our art dealing existence. So we were all sitting around, and an email came in from South Africa from a guy who had bought one of those sort of cardboard trays that you get in supermarkets for food, but it was at a sale room, and it was full of trinkety objects. A metal lobster, a brass bowl, one of those recorders that children used to sort of play on, and yeah, probably still do for all I know, and a miniature in a highly elaborate gilded bronze frame. In fact, so elaborate that in order to defray some of the £27 that this tray of objects cost him, the guy sold the frame on. But having taken the miniature, for it was like a miniature portrait.
You have to explain what a miniature is.
I thought I might. It's not booze either.
Because when I listened to the podcast, I said that you started discussing a miniature. One of the questions was, what is a miniature going to be? And it's painted on ivory.
Well, it can be on ivory. It can be on vellum. It can be on card. And it's a small scale portrait, an intimate portrait that goes right back to Elizabethan times. It was normally the preserve of lovers, members of the close family, sometimes your children. It was a keepsake image, which has been rather replaced today by the iPhone image, really, that image you have of the family. You know, you bring it out and you show it. And you would sometimes wear these things. You would wear them, and you get sort of images of Regency ladies with them about their bosom. And you could secrete them in your pocket. So this is what this is. It's a small-scale portrait. It happens to be on ivory. And a lot of them were painted on ivory from the mid-18th century onwards, of Charles Dickens. But what had happened was, because it had gone to South Africa, and how it ended up there is just so ridiculously epic. It'll take a bit of time to tell if we can get round to it. But what he saw through the mold and fungus, for I kid you not, and this is what happens sometimes with paintings that go to the tropics, that it had become so obscured that he could barely make it out. That was the reason he'd sold on the frame. But despite all of that, the eyes that looked through the fungus, which was a bit like someone looking at you through vines, was enough for him to fathom that it was really interesting and quite possibly a portrait of Dickens. And he did what everyone does these days. He Googled around and found an engraving of this picture. That was when the story began to unfurl. So he thought he was onto something interesting. He sent it to us. Fortunately, my miniature consultant was there at the time, Emma Rutherford, and she looked at it. She brought it to me. We both looked at the screen. She pointed out a few things, and we then realized it had happened. The lost portrait of Charles Dickens, last seen in public 174 years ago, officially lost in the artist's own lifetime. There's a letter in creaky writing from the artist, who was a woman late in life, saying, I've lost sight of it. And it had returned, of all places, in a box of trinkets in South Africa.
When you say it's a miniature, how I'm holding up a postcard here for anyone who's watching this. How much bigger or smaller is it than that?
It's the palm of your hand. the size of the palm of your hand. It's 5 inches.
It's tiny.
Yeah.
But the story goes on because it's a fantastic story. It's such an integral part of Dickens's life, this portrait, really. It's around the time he's writing, exactly the time he's writing Christmas Carol, 175 years ago.
Mm. Yeah, so the first reference that he makes to A Christmas Carol in a letter is one of the days that he was sitting to Margaret Gillies. The two actions, the painting of the portrait and the writing of A Christmas Carol, are deeply enmeshed in all sorts of ways, actually, which I can come to. But what had happened was that Margaret Gillies, a radical, actually, in many ways, she was a sort of proto-suffragist. She was an illustrator of government reports, the first person to illustrate the parlous state of children in the mines, for example. And she really cared about making a difference in the same way. We don't think of Dickens quite like this enough, but he was a reformer himself. I mean, his family had been in debtor's jail. And around him in London, you know, which was called in those days the Venice of Drains, there was so much that would make your heart bleed. And in a slightly edited way, of course, it comes into his books. But, you know, imagine the hard grime, the pain, the human suffering that he was also able to see and wanted to do something about it. So, Margaret Gillies, female artist, most unusual, and Dickens, they get together. Margaret Gillies is doing a book, or illustrating a book, called A New Spirit of the Age, which is a compendium of biographies of movers and shakers, creative movers and shakers in early Victorian England. And this picture is for the front page, next to the front page of the book, this image of Dickens. So they sit and they talk. And we don't know what the conversations were that took place, but let me tell you something really interesting, which I only learnt today, and I've had this portrait around for a few months. And that is that the ghost of Christmas Present in A Christmas Carol, which is, after all, one of those stories that most people you come across have heard of, mm-hmm. if not read, takes Scrooge down to the mines to see the terrible images that Margaret Gillies was portraying.
Mm.
And they were considered so shocking, they were considered unfit for women to look at in the Victorian times. So these were two radicals who were getting together, produced this image. But Margaret Gillies saw something in Charles Dickens, which, again, was something I hadn't really twigged myself. And he was a man of huge charisma.
Mm.
He's twisted to you. He's, you know, contrapposto, they've called it, from the 17th century, which is this dramatic turn of the body. He's got these great dark locks of hair. He's got these brown eyes that bore into you, the same eyes that picked up on everything around him in London, and they're looking at you. And that's so affecting. And also rather doleful, because it was a difficult time for him. And she picked up on that. This was a female artist who really knew what she was doing and produced this image, which then became so famed.
And Charles Dickens at the time, his career, he wasn't sure about it, was he? His career was a bit on the wane. And then the Christmas Carol made him... made him hugely famous.
He'd had a couple of flops. He was overdrawn at the bank. And he wasn't quite sure what was going to happen next. Now, originally, A Christmas Carol was going to be a campaigning pamphlet, but he suddenly realized that here was a story.
Yeah.
And what a story. Simon Callow was reading some of it to a group of us last night, and it's riveting. It's so modern as well. But he wrote it in 6 weeks. At a white-hot gallop, he managed to get it all down in that sort of breathless richness that Dickens is capable of. And it saved him. It was the turning point in his career.
And then he goes on to be as big as the Beatles when he goes to America. That's what they say, isn't it, when he arrives there?
America was a bit before that. And actually his American papers, the things he'd written about America hadn't gone down that well. But you're so right. He was... greatly feted, followed down the street. People wanted to snip bits of his hair, probably like they do with you.
Oh, yeah,
they?
Yeah, there's none left, though. So. Yeah.
Is that why?
Yeah, that's exactly why. I'm so famous, I can't afford to have hair anymore. It was an interesting time, though. It was fascinating about it. I have so many questions to ask you about art, but what was great about your podcast and listening to that was suddenly I realized how important art is in the world of history as well. It was kind of the perfect storm, wasn't it? Margaret Gillies coming together with Charles Dickens. That portrait, if she hadn't decided to paint that portrait, we might not have had Christmas Carol. We might not have had, which was quite influential, I imagine, at the time.
Hugely.
Helped social reform, which is something we're very proud of for doing that. But so that's why our art can be really important. How much value can you put on something like that, then?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question, and I can answer that in two ways. There's a lovely quote, which I can sort of produce, like a sword from a scabbard. And it's from the historian Carlyle in the 19th century, around about the time that Lawrence, not Lawrence, that's Thomas Lawrence, the portrait painter, that's another story, we'll come to that in a moment, Charles Dickens was living. And he said, portraiture is like holding a candle up to history. And I know exactly what he means, because I feel with this Dickens that's re-emerged, Dickens in a way that we never really perceived him. That has what's happened in a sort of flickering way. We can develop an attachment to Dickens that a billion words wouldn't necessarily be able to do in the same way. So it has, I think, a really important role to play. But where it became most interesting to me, and in fact, I've never really talked about it in public because I wasn't allowed to at the time, but when I was relatively young, in my sort of mid to late 20s, I was given a position because I was selling so many pictures, portraits, because that's what I specialized in when I was younger, to the House of Commons, that they decided to create a new position called Works of Art Advisor to the House of Commons and House of Lords, which was brilliant because I was in my 20s and looking for a bit of respectability. And so I suddenly... got this.
Can I just rescue that glove off Cedric? That's all right.
Sorry.
It's the one I used to groom the cat.
We've lost so much to our dog. He's chewed his way through our life, really.
But it's a beautiful thing.
In fact, the thing I'm dreading most is we've borrowed for the Dickens Museum in our gallery for the exhibition that's taking place at the moment, Charles Dickens's hairbrush.
Oh, no.
And I've just had a nightmare. You know, I've just had this sort of cold, sweaty vision of Cedric the Whippet grabbing it. He loves hairbrushes more than words can express. Can you imagine? How would I explain that one?
Yeah, that would be a toughie. So what is the role? What do you do with the role?
So I had this Works of Art Advisor at the House of Commons. So what it was a committee of MPs who wanted to decorate, and still do, the corridors of power within the Palace of Westminster with portraits and paintings. And I got, for about 4 or 5 years, very close to the thinking and strategy of one of the chairs of this. His name was Tony Banks. He's dead now.
Yeah, I know Tony really well because I'm a Chelsea fan. He used to go up to Chelsea. I used to see him all the time. He's such an amazingly beautiful man.
Wasn't he? Wonderful.
Just incredible. Yeah. And he really did care.
He really cared.
And so if you think politicians don't care, some of them might not, but someone like Tony Banks, he cared so much.
He cared so much. And I've got a sort of Tony Banks shape, which has not been filled since his death, which is about, 7 or 8 years ago now, isn't it? In fact, I was one of the people who gave an oration at his funeral. And we used to meet every week. We used to have a whale of a time. So the Works of Art Committee were sitting because they'd been given a lump sum of money to commission a statue of Margaret Thatcher, and it was Labour dominated. Tony, of course, was chair of the GLC, so he had no warmth towards Thatcher. But the money to buy a statue to put in the House of Commons, which was acceptable at the time because there were other 20th century prime ministers, had been offered to the Palace of Westminster. And the Labour guys on the committee said words to the effect of, and I was watching all of this, over our dead body, will we have a statue of Margaret Thatcher in the Palace of Westminster, even though there were precedents for living figures. And suddenly I realized the power of art. You know, when you combine art and politics together, suddenly something sort of fragrantly creative can become really emotive. And what was absolutely brilliant was the way Tony Banks used that to turn the committee. What he said was, because he wanted the statue there, he said, for goodness sake, we have to have something to pull down come the revolution. But for me, it was a real lesson about, and actually continue to be, advising the House of Commons Works of Art Committee, how art, when you combine it with politics, suddenly becomes so much more important. Politics is ephemeral. It's here today, gone tomorrow. Great art is about endurance. Put the two together, and people get very prickly and excited.
Oh, so what do you think then in, say, America at the moment? They're pulling down all those statues. They're trying to destroy a lot of things of anyone who is... I mean, even people want to get rid of Churchill stuff over here, don't they? Because what do you feel about
Cecil
that?
Cecil Rhodes and stuff like that. Well, I mean, in a way, it's quite exciting that art can still get people so hot under the collar. So a side of me says, you know, good on you, good on art, because it's alive and well. But also, I'm one of those people who believes that what's so fascinating and wonderful about the world we live in is the evidence of its evolution in all sorts of ways, both natural and cultural and artificial. And somewhere like London is so thrilling because all around you, up until the fire of London, there's a few buildings before, you've got it all around you. So I think editing the past is a really dangerous thing. Mm. And it feels to me aesthetically, ethically, very dodgy.
Mm. What happens to your Charles Dickens portrait then? You obviously have to give it some money to the guy who found it.
Yeah. So we acquired it from him at that point, having no idea whether or not we could restore it, because it was a particularly virulent form of South African fungus and mold that was growing over the surface. And it then went for weeks, months to the Victoria and Albert Museum, where a restorer there worked on it. And bit by bit, using scalpels, because you can't use solvents on something as vulnerable and as soft as watercolour on ivory, he was able to get rid of it. And from beneath this... A creature of time in South Africa emerged, you know, rather like a sort of hatching damselfly, this beautiful face. Mm. In fact, quite a lot of the academics, the female academics who've seen it today, because it was announced at 6 o'clock last night and it came out this morning, have said what an attractive man he is. Mm. I think it's done a lot for him. It's that candle up to history again.
Mm-hmm. But what happens to it then now?
So we are working very closely with the Dickens Museum, who are going to raise the money, we hope, with an appeal, if people will support it, so that it can be acquired. Now, the Dickens Museum in Doughty Street is where Dickens lived.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful place. Yeah. You know, you must go if you haven't been. We've borrowed a group of objects from it in our gallery. And incidentally, you must come and see the picture with us in Pall Mall. It's going to be on display until about the 28th of Jan. Or is it a bit earlier? 25th. 25th of Jan. But come and see it, because I've done a film as well, a sort of 7 or 8 minute film. You can go and sit down. And it's also, the idea is to bring your children as well, because he is, after all, the man who invented Christmas.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a day out. And they'll buy it with any luck.
And listen to the podcast as well prior to going. Is that something on philipmould.com, isn't it? Is that where you go to it? Or entail.com. It is very good. We'll put the link up anyway on our piece. It's just really perfect for this time of year as well.
Thank you.
So
we had some great contributors, and you know, Dickens, Dickens, there's so much meat on the bone.
Let's talk a bit about you before we get back to art. How did you become so interested in art? It's been part of your life since you were a child, hasn't it?
Yeah, it is. So my mother was in a wheelchair. She got polio really in her sort of mid 20s, if I recall correctly. And she'd had my elder sister and brother, but not me at that point. And what happened was she was entirely disabled from the waist downwards with this polio. There was a lot of polio around at that time. It came over, I think, it came over with the troops after the sort of disbanding of armies after the Second World War. And she loved antiques, adored them. So what she would do is, with her hand controls, wheelchair in the back, she would drive around antique shops with me in the car, or my older brother before me. And if she saw something interesting in the window of a shop, of an antique shop, she'd park in front of them, in the days when there were antique shops, in the days when you could park.
Yeah.
and she would eye something interesting, and she would send me in. And this was in on the Wirral, in Hoylake, and Heswall. And what I would do is I would come in and out, and in the process of that, you know, picking up Staffordshire figures and pots and what have you, you could say a little bit stuck to my fingers. And I got interested. And the epiphany for me was when I met an antique dealer called Zena. She was about 60. She was in the back of the shop like an owl with all these objects around, like a roosting owl. I remember the place just stank of beeswax and number six cigarettes and silver dip. You know that awful smell of silver dip? Have you smelled silver dip?
No.
Oh, it smells of hell. it smells of sulfur.
All right. Okay.
And it's so she, there was the mixture of all three. It was heady when I walked in, but she was she had a sort of Svengali like quality with children. She could draw them. She was in fact a retired teacher, and she became an antique dealer later on. And she asked me to pick up a piece of silver when my mother was waiting for me in the car outside. And then she asked me to have a look at the hallmarks. And if you're a kid and you've got someone who is good at it telling you about hallmarks, it's like hieroglyphs. It's like Indiana Jones. And you know, hallmarks, you've got the head of the king or queen who's on the throne. You've got the date letter, which always changes, different styles of alphabet. You've got the lovely sort of evocative signs of the city in which it's made, you know, an anchor for Birmingham, a sword and three sheaths for Chester and so on. And then you've got the name, the actual name of the person in the form of the initials. And you can look all of these things up. And so a boring teaspoon suddenly becomes a Dickens novel, and so that's what she could do.
Well, I was going to say, as part of my interview I've written here, you have turned yourself into Indiana Jones. That's kind of, it's sort of that stroke a sleuth. You in your television work, haven't you? Because you've gone from obviously those beginnings into having your own empire, own art gallery, and you're a dealer in art and everything. And then you've gone on to TV where you've got Fake or Fortune, which is a bit like that, isn't it? We're going to find a piece of art and then we're going to decide whether it's real or not. With Fiona Bruce, how quickly, when you look at a piece of art, do you know whether it's real or fake?
I don't think I ever know completely. I mean, I've been wrong a lot of times.
Have you?
And the thing is about Fake or Fortune is, and there were a couple of examples in the last series, which was in July and August, is that we can be absolutely convinced about an object. We can prepare the case, we can do the forensics, the stylistic analysis, the provenance, you know, make it follow back right almost to the moment that the wet paint was applied by the artist. Put it all down on writing and on paper, hand it to the expert in question. So all great artists have their appointed man or woman on earth whose job it is to sort of work out whether it is or it isn't by that artist. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's how it happens is another story, but they exist, the art world listen to them. And sometimes they can say no when you think they should be saying yes. When in fact, you think there's no other alternative but for them to say yes. But they can say no. And that jeopardy, which incidentally, there's that, the BBC love that word jeopardy. They say, okay, Phil, that's a great story.
Where's the jeopardy?
You know? Yeah. They're right. Because if you look at all television these days, successful television, with the possible exclusion of your show, actually. It's about that there's a denouement of is it or isn't it, will they or won't they, who's going to win.
Oh, we sometimes have that with a souffle.
Yeah, well, there you are.
Well, we don't really.
So I know. So, look, obviously, nothing brings oxygen to the brain better than financial risk. I've spent 35 years buying art. I've got quite good at it, but I can still make mistakes. And one of the real problems is with 20th century art, because the greatest challenge for fakers is really the illusion of age, creating 300 or 400 years, the appearance of 300 or 400 years old, and that's really difficult. Really do, you know, despite all the tea that you might, you know, cover it with, you know, the cracks that you can introduce into the paint, the dirt that you can impregnate it with, you can sort of sniff it. You can know.
Okay.
But with 20th century stuff, the illusion of age is not so much an issue. Then add the fact that so much 20th century art, and I noticed a piece of your art as I walked in, incidentally, I would like to talk to you about that later, art you've collected. So much 20th century art is conceptual. It's not about that high degree of craftsmanship that characterizes old art. So therefore, you don't have to go through the sort of the virtuosity of a great old master. You don't have to create the age, and therefore people fall foul of it. And do you know, about 70% of all the art that you see online these days, particularly in the big auction sites, the big selling sites, is in some way or another misrepresented.
That's incredible, isn't it? Mm. That's a huge market then for fakes.
It's huge, and they can hide. You see, the faker can hide online. You can hide.
How do you price, unless you put it into an auction, how can you price art? Is it just a guess? There must be a certain price range over it, you're just guessing.
How do you do it? So one of the really useful things is auctions. And we have records, and in fact, one of the things we do when we research a picture is find out whether it's ever been at auction. We have records of auctions that go back to the 18th century.
Right.
When organizations like Christie's had got going. And auctions produce prices. Prices are in the public domain. So they become sort of precedents that everyone can see this. Uh-huh. Now, auctions only cover a percentage of what is sold, but it is nonetheless conspicuous. And it's quite useful because you can say, something comparable by that artist 10 years ago made X. We've moved on. This is quite like that, but not quite. But a little bit here, a bit more green, a bit bigger. The world has moved on. It's worth X or Y. Yes, there's a degree of subjectivity, you know, like selling anything. I mean, it's, you know, selling a car, you can have the same conversation sometimes. A combination of precedence and sort of poetic persuasive power, which is rather what an art dealer has to sometimes bring to bear.
Does art go down in value as well as art?
Oh, yeah. And I used to do the Antiques Roadshow. In fact, yes. I still do. I keep a hand in it. It's great fun, but utterly exhausting.
Well, everyone loves watching it just in case. Just in case someone finds something. How often? Is there still lots of stuff left around for us to find, do you think?
Yeah, but also it's being generated all the time. You see, people aren't interested so much in 18th and 19th century. It's 20th century, everyone seems to be in thrall of these days. And the 20th century has produced huge amounts of stuff, and not everything is recorded. It'd be quite interesting to see whether the Antiques Roadshow survives in the next 20 or 30 years with so much digital record of things around. You know, you're going to be able to find things. Although I have to say, every expert uses Google, but before they, not every expert. And I can imagine, having said that, a few experts are going to say, "What?" but of course Google is. And you know, only a fool would not use Google if you've got a couple of hours and you're trying to work out whether or not some comparable object has made a little money or lots of money or what have you. So that's what we do.
Sorry, I interrupted you. You were about to tell me how...
I can't remember, yes.
You were about to tell me how...
Oh, yes, okay, yeah.
Art devalues as well.
So we get people coming to us with Victorian landscapes, let's say. Do you remember in the old days when my mother was driving me around and getting me to go into antique shops and pilfer the things in the window. Those were the days when Victorian landscapes and old objects were really collected.
Right.
But there has been a quantum shift in taste. And 18th and 19th century watercolours, safe art, those things in the bobbly gilt frames, more traditional, non-modernist stuff, has gone down in value very substantially. In fact, you've heard the expression, the brown furniture syndrome. You know, people hate now brown furniture in the way, you know. That it seems
I hadn't
to be,
heard that, but yeah, okay, I like it.
Okay,
yeah.
The brown furniture syndrome. And if you want to, well, if the aesthetic antithesis of that would be IKEA.
Right.
You know, but big dining room table, brown dining room tables, sideboards. Who do you know has a, you know, sideboard these days? We all eat in our kitchens, you know.
Yeah.
So it's partly practical, it's partly aesthetic. But the brown furniture syndrome has pulled down that area as well. For sort of cultural and aesthetic reasons, not practical reasons, because, you know, you can always find room on your wall for pictures. But the result is that some of the paintings that we see are worth a half, sometimes a third of what they were 20 to 30 years ago, which is shocking, because you always think that antiques go up in value.
Yes.
But they don't. Whereas some of your 20th century things that you might have bought then, which were worthless almost, could be highly collected.
How do you value a 21st century artist then?
Well, that's a different thing altogether, really, because in order to be an art dealer for a living artist, you're almost like an impresario. You're selling by strength of personality. By a belief that you impart to the potential buyer that A, it's wonderful, that it expresses something that no one can see except the artist, and that in generations to come, people will think even more highly of this artist. It's a different thing. It's a bit actually like the Grand National. No, it's not like the Grand National, because there's far more many runners. You know, there's so much contemporary art is being produced. It's baffling, it's dazzling. So what you want is, and this is why I want to come back to this object that I saw as I walked into your house. What you want with contemporary art is an artist who, to use the Grand National analogy, has left the stalls, has done one circuit already, is heading towards Beeches Brook, and hasn't fallen.
Right.
You know, you need to make sure that sort of what you're dealing with, because there's so much nonsense out there.
Though, isn't there people who curate it for us, like Charles Saatchi comes along and goes,
yeah.
Hey, Damien Hirst, Tracy Emin, you know, you guys, you're the ones, the Chapman brothers, whoever, you're the guys that I'm putting my money on. Mm. Yeah, I'm putting my riders on your horses.
Mm.
And then as soon as he says, didn't he create a whole industry, basically?
He did, but then Charles Saatchi moves on. The art dealers move on. The museums have to put different pictures in their museums. I mean, some museums can barely close their doors because they've got so much kit. You know, the critics, the Vox Populi, the Zeitgeist view and feelings move on.
Yeah.
So, and the artist dies. The artist is so important as a part of, you think of Damien Hirst or Tracy Emin, they're indivisible from their product. And so the tools to market these things, the people around them,
uh-huh.
move on. So unless the art is genuinely significant and enduring, it's not going to last. And I think you're going to see an awful lot of very unhappy people in the next 10 or 20 years who realizes there is no secondary market, as we call it, in the art that they've bought.
So I was going to say, is the sheep or the shark in formaldehyde, is that the equivalent of Monet or Leonardo da Vinci in years to come? Or does this eventually lose its value?
Well, so you've got the inherent problem that the materials used aren't enduring, they're ephemeral. That's going to be an issue. A Rembrandt is made to last.
Yeah.
A shark in formaldehyde, you know, however much you look after it, has got a limited lifespan.
Unmade bed.
Unmade bed, well, you know, possibly there again. So what I could say about those artists is, it's possible that they have scratched deeply enough in the stone of art history for them to remain, but an awful lot like them will probably go by the wayside. And
right.
You know, what is very interesting is you know, someone like Damien Hirst, who has, I don't know, 150 staff, three factories producing this stuff, is people are still interested and happy to commit themselves to what is a factory product. It's actually, they're buying a brand, but we know what happens to brands. Brands move on, yeah. You know, brands are taken over by others. Some last. The greatest brand in English history must be the Tudor Rose.
Okay, good.
So I just give you that thought.
So that's okay. I'm just letting that sink in. So the classic artists never had anybody else help them. They were just, it was always...
No, actually, I'm so glad you brought that up. No, someone like Van Dyck or Lely, or the portrait painter after him, or Titian, they would have a studio of assistants. To do things. But what they didn't have was post-industrial revolution means of production. You know, the polka dots, the materials, yeah. the supports, bulk buying, that sort of thing. It's slightly different. Although it is fair to say that it's not new. Uh-huh. And the market does make a big distinction between a studio work by Titian, which could be worth £10,000, £15,000, £20,000, £30,000, possibly on a good day with the wind behind it, or £5 to £50 million for a really great one that the artist has anointed himself.
You implied on Twitter not so long ago that Banksy thing which happened in the auction.
Yeah.
The sleuthing, you said... Maybe it was Banksy who bought himself, knowing the value of it we got. Mm. That's what I'm reading into your tweet. That's basically
you'd be right. The reason I put that tweet out was, okay, so that was the picture that was gobbled up before all our eyes when it had made £1 million.
Shredded.
At auction. It was shredded, exactly. Shredded. Only half shredded, though.
I did notice it.
So you could hang it.
Yeah.
So the very same image of the little girl, with a balloon, isn't it? I think it is.
Yes.
It's a girl with a balloon.
Yeah.
But the very same image, very comparable, slightly smaller, made about 300,000 or thereabouts, £300,000 earlier in the year.
Yeah.
So it began, I smelt a rat here. So you can always make an object achieve any price at auction, you just bid it up yourself. Even if you put it in yourself, you can find someone to bid it up. And then you can get two people to bid it up to make sure it really does properly go up. Or you can bid against reserve or what have you. The fact that it made £1 million, the fact that apparently journalists had been tipped off that something was going to happen, made me feel that it was, to use the word I was using earlier on, the impresario at work. But who knows? It's speculation.
What do you think of him? Because it's now worth more, isn't it, than it went for, much more. What do you think of Banksy?
Well,
do you like him?
I've got a friend whose son was playing in a band in Bristol about 8 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And after they had finished playing, they gathered on some steps to have a drink. And down upon his head was dropped from 5 or 6 floors above, with a beautiful red cord around it, a scrolled up picture. And he unscrolled it, unfurled it, and there was an image of Spider-Man with a bubble coming from his mouth saying, "Watch out, it's Banksy." And so he thinks that, and he's brought it to me, he thinks that he might have been Banksy'd. Now, I've discussed it with my staff, one of whom actually thinks he knows a Banksy when he sees it, and he's concerned that it doesn't quite look good enough for Banksy.
Right.
But what a lovely touch, eh? What a lovely thought.
I like him. I like what he... Do you like what he... Do you know who he is?
No. Well, we're not meant to know, are we?
I think that's so bizarre in the art world that no one knows who he is. You must do.
I think we probably do. I think if we worked hard enough, we could work it out. I've got a friend, a very prominent portrait painter, who said he went to dinner with Banksy the other day. I'm sure we can find out. But what is so lovely is that the media will join in the conspiracy. Of course he can be outed, probably, or he does exist. He might, of course, be one or two people. Might be three people, who knows?
Yeah, that's a good point.
And he does have this company called Pest Control, which right. is... So he's a corporate entity as well.
Yeah.
But what it says is a lot of the media don't, you know, they could almost certainly establish it, but they establish its identity, but they don't, because we need a bit of fantasy.
Yeah, I went to Dismorland, which he set up, and that was fantastic. That was really good.
Wasn't that very clever? It was just great.
You just mentioned there a minute ago you can bid up artists, obviously, but you guys are powerful, aren't you? Because we're the guys who are going to buy the art. You can get together with a couple of your mates and go, come on, let's overprice everything. We can make some more cash. Surely there's that racket going on in the art world, is there?
But remember, it's an expensive way of doing it, because if you do that, and it's frankly unethical, right. If you do that, you've then got to pay the auction house their commission, which slaughters you these days. It's 10% buyers, 10% for the seller, and like when you added everything up, about 30% for the buyer.
Right.
So about 40% of the object is taken by these agents. You could try that game, but it gets expensive.
Talking about being ethical, I had a friend who likes buying art, gets invited to. He spends tens of thousands. This guy's very rich, and he said there's sort of unwritten laws which are you're not supposed to buy art just to flip it. They don't like it, and if you do that, if you keep buying art and just flipping it to try and make more money, they stop inviting you to these things. They want you to buy art to collect. Is there like unwritten laws for you guys in the art world?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, if you have a relationship with an artist, it's very important that you keep that relationship going by some mutual trust. It's a partnership, and also that presupposes that all art is going up, or a lot of art is going up. A lot of it isn't. A lot of it's just static. It's pretty few artists who are on a trajectory. And in those instances, normally what they do is they have a strong relationship with their dealer to make sure nothing untoward happens or nothing odd happens. Mm.
How do you feel when you come across a piece of art that, like Charles Dickens one, when you actually realize what you've got there? How does that make you feel? Someone like you who's been doing this for years and years, you still get that buzz.
Well, you see, the thing about art dealers are, generally speaking, they can't paint themselves. And there is something genuinely creative about finding a painting by an artist, and particularly by a long-dead artist. With some of the artists like Gainsborough, who I've had the good fortune to find quite a lot of, or Van Dyck even, one almost feels that they're looking after you because you're looking after them. And when you find one of their works, there's a sort of sense in which you're sort of like reconnecting with them. So there's that sort of spiritual dimension of connecting with an artist who, you know, poor artists, their work is being ignored. It's being overlooked, or it's being, worse still, ascribed to another artist.
Yeah.
Which is not them. Then there's the process of cleaning it and restoring it. And that is probably where more discoveries are made than any other before. And the art of a great art discoverer is to understand dirt, understand overpaint. With the areas that are not covered up, and I can tell you about overpaint, because this overpaint is the motif in the world of art discovery. It's looking at the areas that are not covered by all of these sort of later layers and saying, that's interesting. Then you've got to light it, then you've got to write it up, then you've got to frame it. And all of that is quite a big deal. So actually, it's a wonderful thing because you are almost part of the artistic process yourself. So you've asked me what it's like when you make a discovery. It's very satisfying. And you feel as though you're joining in with what the artist intended.
Right.
But also it's laced with risk. And you know, rather like doctors, we proclaim our successes, but we bury our failures.
That's what my granddad used to always say. He used to always say, I'm not going to the doctors, they bury their mistakes. So he used to always say that. It always makes me laugh. Oh, that's good. So These. By the way, why don't we talk about my piece of art then? You want
to
ask?
Yeah. No, tell me about it because I mean, first thing is, what is unusual, and it shows you're bold. It shows you're not quite like other men, actually.
Oh.
Because you have an installation. You have a you have a really conspicuous form of a boy with a grenade behind a piece of glass. So tell me what you know about it. Or in the Antiques Roadshow, as they say, has it been in the family long?
How long ago did I buy him? About maybe 5 years ago. I was at a do for pancreatic cancer. My brother died of pancreatic cancer. And as I walked into this room, they always have auctions at these things, as you know. I saw him. He's a little boy. He's from an artist called Scooney, who's now a really good friend of mine. Love the guy. Amazing artist. And he does this boy soldier sculpture thing, installation thing. And he had his dressed as Max, this one I won him, Max from Where the Wild Things Are. He's got that with a big furry tail, which you can't really see. I had to put him in that glass case because everyone kept on touching him because they can't resist it. Right. Everyone who comes into my house. Anyway, let me tell you, first of all, the way it made me feel, I went, I have to have that. So I've never bid in an auction before. It's very exciting. Mm. However, it's scary as well, because when people go, it's just another, I'm going to be uncouth, but it's just another £500. It's just another £500. I can do that. Those £500 start adding up, don't they? But so I had him, and he's absolutely amazing. But what I love about it is when people come into the house, my reaction was, I want it. But people say, I either hate it or they love it. They go, it scares the life out of me. And I think that's what art should do. It should give you a feeling.
Yeah.
Is that how you feel?
Oh, definitely. But that feeling can also be a subtle one of beauty, of putting something that can't be put into words in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
What I love that idea of like music, it can just get to that concept or thought or to that plateau that can't be reached in other forms, and that can be aggression. It can be escapism. I think what I found quite head-turning about that work of art that you've got is that it works as a performance. It's something to do with a child's face. It's the grenade in his hand in his sitting room. But there is something about it. It could be horrible. It could be inappropriate. You know, it could be trying too hard, but it's sort of somehow not. Either the child can be assimilated because of the work of art, or perhaps you've done it so well in the room it's in. But I found myself awarding it validity, and there's an awful lot of junk around which I don't. So, and that's why I wanted to bring it up.
Oh, good.
And I think it's bold. I think it's a bold thing you've done.
Thank you. Oh, well, that's what I felt about it. When I saw it, I just thought, I really want that. I think that's something I want to own. But then I'm worried about owning art. We've discussed this on podcast before. What does owning art mean? It's signaling. This is who I am. So you're right. Maybe I'm signaling. I'm brave and I'm bold, and I've got an installation in my house rather than just a piece of art. An art dealer said to me once, hanging mirrors is for timid, scared people. Hang art, it's bold and it says something. And it's kind of, is that right?
Yeah. I mean, if you go back to the origins of a painting, you're probably going back, if you're not worried now about sort of prehistoric images on cave walls, although actually probably it's rather similar. I'm really thinking of Roman villas where they have those big views of gardens, sometimes beautifully done with birds and flowers and what have you. The painting is a sort of window. It's a form of escape from the claustrophobia of your existence, of where you are. And I rather love that idea. They are portals into another world. And that's how I see them on a sort of anthropological level. That's what they do for us. And remember, we all lived in caves, and caves need things. And I think probably there's cave drawings, although there's a lot of shamanist ideology at work, and goodness knows what they were for. And some of them are, incidentally, phenomenally well done.
Uh-huh.
The feeling of speed in some of the cattle or not the cattle, whatever prehistoric cattle are called, but you know the way they're moving, that both as a group and singly. I mean, these were clever artists who, at work, and there were a lot of them who seemed to be clever. It performs some solace or some portal into the imagination or something mystical in the confines of the space that you're in, like music can be in the space you're in, like food can do for you.
What you're saying is brilliant and fascinating now, because I went to see a, it's changed my mind dramatically, I went to see a talk with Anthony Gormley, and he said...
Amazing man.
Right, but he said what was interesting, he was in an art gallery once, he was about to put some of his work in an art gallery, and he realised that he was sitting there was 20 people in the art gallery, but outside there was hundreds of people walking past. And he said something to the words of, I thought my artwork should be out there where everyone can see it, rather than in here where only a few people can see it. Everyone should have to see my art, whether they like it or not. But that's interesting because he's doing statues or statues and what do you call them? Installations and things like that. So they're
and most famously Angel of the North.
Angel of the North. So they're very much things for outside. Yeah, but quite. So it's a different form of art then, isn't it? Yeah, what he's talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
But he also said that the 20th century would be the century that would be remembered for people locking art away and getting quite snobby about it, sticking it in galleries and saying, you can't come and see my art, I own it. It's words like that. I'm not quite saying exactly what he said, but it was sort of similar to that. Do you agree with that?
I think so. I think so. I mean, I think what I find very interesting about so many artists like Anthony Gormley, and almost every image, as I'm sure you know, every human image is a self-portrait. That's what even Angel of the North, the looked at sculpture, because the amount of motorists that pass in Europe. It's his body, and I think he is of a. I'm moving on from your question actually into a slightly different sphere now. But an awful lot, probably too much art, is to do with autobiography and oneself, one's own sexual identity, racial identity, where you stand in the art world. They're all valid things, but historically, artists were people who just took on subject matter beyond themselves. You know, like landscape, like religious stuff, stuff that didn't necessarily have to relate back to me.
Yeah,
it's become. I think a lot of art has become rather campaigning.
Okay,
and I think art has got is broader than that.
Yes,
it's cleverer than that. You know.
Well, where you've changed my mind is I'm always now a championing Banksy and sort of graffiti artists. I say they're like Anthony Gormley, they're putting their work out there for everybody to see. Yeah, and I think it's great. Sure. But where you've changed my mind now is you're saying they're a portal out onto the world. And I think that's so. I'm looking around at my art here, and you can exactly see where I want to go with my world. And I think that's brilliant because I've been doubting my art recently, thinking, why have I got it? And now I understand what it is. It's just it's a blank wall, and I've put something in there, a portal.
Yeah,
that's a brilliant concept. Well, I like that.
But you raised the subject of Anthony Gormley, who I think is a really, having said that a lot of his work is autobiographical, I think he is an artist who grapples with big ideas, and I think he's a wonderful artist and a very clever chap. In fact, his brother is my doctor, is my GP. I call him Angel of the South. he's a very good doctor. But when I was first on the Antiques Roadshow, a local councillor, what's that part of Newcastle that's not New? Tyneside.
Okay.
In Tyneside. A local councillor from Tyneside brought onto the Antiques Roadshow the maquette, the bronze tryout idea on a very small scale of Angel of the North that they had in one of their bat rooms, and it was sort of like moulding away next to some swimming pool materials, and they brought it onto the show, and I valued it, and in fact it was the first £1 million valuation on the Antiques Roadshow.
Brilliant.
I put £1 million on it because I knew that one other similar Angel of the North had made money. I had no idea that I'd created Antiques Roadshow history until I was rung by the Daily Mirror just before the programme went out. It was saying, we're doing a feature and we want your comment, which is on a Friday. And you don't really want to be rung by the Daily Mirror saying they're doing a feature. Yeah, I was dreading what they had in mind. And it was because you've done the first £1 million.
Brilliant.
Quite a lot of people were rather a bit disappointed because they're expecting it to be, you know, a lovely old lady with something in her attic. And actually, it was a councillor who had something that he hadn't monetized. But it was still great fun.
What do you think of the Turner? Do you like the Turner Prize?
Yeah. What I like about the Turner Prize is, and it's actually how we need to assess art these days, actually. It's not just the it's not one work of art. You know, historically, when you judged a competition, you know, there'd be one painting that you look at, but they holistically look at the artist. And it's a bit like photography. Now, you can't judge whether someone's a good photographer on one photograph. You could take 3,000 photographs, and one of them is going to be a genius piece of work, aren't they? So they look, they take a much more broad biographical take on the artist, and they look at the other objects around. There's more than one object. There's a cluster of them sometimes that they consider, and as a result of that, I think it's very intelligent, and I love competitions. We all love competitions, don't we?
Well, I go every year. Well, when I can, I've gone quite a lot of years. I go, not when it's in London, I go definitely. And then I go with friends, and then we just try and pick our winners and see who we think is going to win. And then it's brilliant because you turn into competition. But you do go there, and it does all those pieces of art. They make you feel some way, which is the important thing. I always think about art. If you look at it and it doesn't have an emotion for you, then there's just no point in it, is it? That's what it all is.
No. I think you're right. Where people get really hot under the collar, and I find myself sometimes being sort of savaged at supper parties and what have you, is the alienation that a lot of stuff that is called art brings about, because people say that it shouldn't be art.
Yes.
They could say that about the kid with a grenade in his hand in your living room.
Yeah.
And actually, the part of the problem is we carry with us this historical concept of what art is, which is a sort of, you know, Rembrandt. Yeah. But of course, if you don't worry about that word art and the use of the word in that way, and you embrace it you embrace other things like performance, then suddenly art becomes acceptable. It's purely because it's a sort of semantic thing about the word that worries people and puts people off.
I get scared that I'm going to say something to you which is stupid, which is ignorant. And then that worries me, because that's the same with wine and things like that. So I'd rather just not learn, because I might come across as someone who's ignorant to it all.
I know. And God, I have that fear all the time, particularly with contemporary art, because I'm not a contemporary art person. But I'm one of these people who puts my trust in the elite in these areas, like wine as well. I wouldn't, you know, when I used to drink, I had no idea. But then when they said that's an interesting peppery taste with a slightly baroque curl to it.
Get that.
You know, I said, you're talking my sort of language.
Leonardo da Vinci painting the other day, wasn't it? It went for the most expensive, became the most expensive.
So that was such a big day in the art world when a painting made $450 million before all of our eyes. And it was an old painting as well, a painting by Leonardo da Vinci, although Christie's had very cleverly marketed it in a modern sale.
Right.
But of course, Leonardo is such, to come back to a word I was using earlier, brand, that you can do that. He's bigger than Picasso, isn't he? I mean, he's the definite. He's a synonym. If you looked up on Google, whatever, go to synonyms. You know, he's a synonym for genius, isn't he? You know, you're a Leonardo. You know, so. So they very cleverly put him in front of the eyes of the
artist. I wouldn't know that he's bigger than Picasso. I wouldn't be able to rank all these artists, but I can rank him now because he's $450 million, $450.3.
Yeah, you wouldn't? Leonardo Pesco?
I don't know. No, I don't know. I don't know these things. That's my worry with art.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, so it was a big day.
Leonardo, so it was a very, very big day. And there's been so much conspiracy theory after this sale.
Okay.
About whether or not that two people were actually bidding on it, but they're actually bidding on it for the same person, or that the person who's bought it, because it hasn't been on display, has now decided that it's not by Leonardo and doesn't want to pay for it. You know, all of this stuff. I've no idea whether it's true or not, because you never get a clear answer in the art world. That's one of the things you realize. But let's put all of that aside for a moment. Why did this picture make $450 million? which is the best picture is ever made, and it was an old master. So what was the image? Well, it was an image of Christ. And interestingly, it was bought by a Saudi Arabian. So, I mean, that must be the highest price paid for an image of God as we understand it, or Christ as we understand him, by the Arab nation. What was interesting about it was two things. First, there are only about, I think, 22 paintings by Leonardo da Vinci, unlike Picasso, where there's damn thousands of them. And also, so you know, in order to get here was an opportunity. If you've got billions and billions and billions, this was beautifully marketed as an opportunity, one of the last very, very few opportunities to buy one of the works by probably the greatest artist who's ever lived and might ever continue to live for a few centuries. And secondly, though, it was the image itself, because the Christ image was not actually that holy looking. Yes, he had a sort of a sphere next to him, and he had a rather sort of arresting, spiritual looking expression. But actually, he almost looked a little bit gender fluid. Looking at it, you couldn't quite sort of work out what type of where he was coming from. And I think there was something about that that people found rather enticing. It wasn't like an intimidating old master. It wasn't like a martyrdom or a crucifixion, you know, or a parable scene. So I think that the almost secular nature of the religious subject also gave it accessibility. But what is so fascinating about this picture could have been bought for $11,000 about 10 years ago.
Wow.
Where it came up miscatalogued in an auction. And the reason for that was that it was so dirty, and it comes back to this thing about overpaint and campaigns of overpaint over 300 or 400 years. Can I just tell you about overpaint? Just need to know it because it is the reason. So every time a picture is damaged, a restorer will fill in the area of loss. Mm-hmm. A bad restorer, the sort of restorer equivalent of the builder from hell, will then put paint around that to meld it in a bit.
Right.
You know, like a scratch on a wall, you just put a bit of paint around it. You know? Yeah. And then if this happens two or three times throughout the history of a painting, it can largely disappear beneath these layers of later paint.
Right.
So, and every painting, and particularly oil paintings, get damaged. Okay. So that came up with a lot of overpaint over it, which admittedly was covering a lot of damage. And here's the other interesting thing about this picture. It is by Leonardo da Vinci, but it's also a large part of it by a Brooklyn restorer who put it back together.
So when he gets the picture, does he or she bought the picture, do they get the damaged version or do they get the restored?
So they get the restored version. So what happened by restoring it beautifully, by taking off all the overpaint, by seeing what's left, and then by matching it much more intelligently and thoughtfully, in a way that we understand Leonardo worked, they then revived it and got a sufficient amount of experts to back it.
But surely it's better just to have the damaged version, the original. You know, you don't want them to get the Colosseum in Rome and rebuild it, do you?
Yeah, but if it was the Colosseum covered with paint or covered with, you know, the fumes of passing traffic, or it had got sort of, you know, outside labs attached to it or what have you. You know, this is what overpaint is. Mm. Overpaint is a sort of thoughtless additions to the original. And what it does is it hampers the experts from being able to assess whether it's right or not. So the reason that that picture that made $450 million made only $11,000 was because the overpainted dirt on top of it disguised what was beneath.
Yeah.
And a very clever group of dealers bought it, removed it all, restored it much better, and the manifest strokes of Leonardo became conspicuous.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
11,000. So there's a lot of those looking about, are there? Not Leonardo's, but...
Well, I think there will be, yes. And this is what, slightly, Fake or Fortune is prospering, because there are a lot of paintings, historical paintings out there, that have been overlooked because of condition. And we are getting better and better with our science. There are all sorts of non-invasive ways of looking into a picture now.
Hmm.
You know, looking through the paint surface, through all of this overpaint, to what lies beneath. And there's also so much more data around about what artists used. Now, we now know exactly the binding wax that Turner used for his pigments to make the oil paint work. You know, we know what when a lot of these Renaissance artists used, the minerals and the plant extracts and what have you. Yeah. So we've got the data, we've got the means of looking at these pictures, and so I think we're going to be making more and more discoveries. Until there are none.
And maybe the price is going to keep going up. We've got a situation in the world where there's a lot of people with a lot of money at the moment. People seem to be collecting money, American businessmen and etc. And obviously you mentioned the Arab world, China, Russia. They all like buying art, don't they? And it's kind of a trophy, is it?
Oh, it is. Oh, most definitely. So what you normally find with the international market is they'll want to buy the best of their own, what is perceived as very interesting. What happened, for example, in Australia, when Australia's the economy started improving in the 20th century, Australian art, anything by a major Australian artist, or either historically or the major contemporary ones, just shot up.
Right.
You know, it's happened in Scandinavia a bit, now it's fallen away. Happened in Ireland a great deal. Any Irish art sales, the big auction rooms would have them. Mm. When the economy collapsed, they fell away. And then the really big money wants major trophies. That's why that Leonardo made all of that money. So what they want is what is perceived to be the greats,
yeah,
which everyone else wants. Chinese particularly, I find, influenced by that. They want to know, they're very interested to know what the West really rates, and they want a slice of that. And that's happening more and more. So the Chinese art market is massively expanding.
The greatest painting of all time, Mona Lisa, yeah? Mm-hmm. Isn't that regarded the most expensive painting in the world at the moment?
800? If it's sold...
it's been valued now at the equivalent. I was reading when it got insured, the equivalent insurance now would be $810 million or something like that. So,
I think it would be more.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is the most famous work of art in the world. I think, you see, there are an awful lot of billionaires now, and to own the Mona Lisa, go back to your idea, because yes, there's definitely an element of trophy hunting in collecting, yeah. And I've known that, and you know, I'm not ashamed to say, as art dealers, we furnish that, from time to time, not always, but from time to time. I think you'd be looking at increments of that's when the auctioneer goes up, by a unit of probably 100 million a time, and I think you'd probably get to. I wouldn't be surprised if the interest would begin to peter out at around about 3 to 5 billion. Mona Lisa.
Why is
come
it?
On, it would be. Of course,
why is
of course,
it? Why is it the most famous painting in the world? And who owns it?
Ah, well, I'm so pleased you brought that up, because it connects me with the book I'm just starting to write.
Brilliant.
I've been given 2 years to deliver it, and it's a roundup of the 50 or 60 most timeless old masters. I'm going to call it, the working title is Old Masters, but the word old crossed out, because there are certain old masters like the Mona Lisa, which just bounce down the centuries into your arms. There's something about the humanity in them, something about some of the attributes. And for instance, there's an El Greco in the Metropolitan Museum of a cardinal wearing horn-rimmed glasses. It should be painted, it was painted late 16th, very early 17th century, but it really could be today,
okay,
because of the glasses.
Right.
And it sort of restores your faith in the old, and it reconnects you with the old. And because old masters are now slightly dropping off the perch because everyone's so enthralled with contemporary, the book is designed to reconnect you with old masters, to teach you a little bit about old masters by a lineup of 50. But they are all like the Mona Lisa, but I don't necessarily want to include that for that reason, because it's so obvious. They're ones that you can connect with, because these were people like you and I creating these things. So often they're drenched in fashion and protocol of the period, but sometimes they're not. And those are the thrilling ones. And I see my job as a communicator in art to put those in front of you as an apologist for old masters.
So why is the Mona Lisa the most...
Okay, so why the Mona Lisa is... Well, it's actually probably more famous because it's been so famous than it should be. It's become a cliche, But it's to do with her expression, isn't it? It's to do with the smile. And one thing that hasn't changed, and you get this, you know, read Shakespeare, which I've been trying to do for years. Sense of humours, avarice, lust, it's all the same. So all you need is someone to be able to do that 500 years ago in a way that is not overcome by the fashions of the period, and you can connect because they're human beings like you. And that's what you get in the Mona Lisa, I think. You can connect with that enigmatic smile. It's also very, very beautiful, isn't it? And I go back to the work of art that you have in your sitting room with the guy, the little boy with the grenade. And the word beauty, when you were describing it, didn't come into it, interestingly. It wasn't really an issue. And the way you've talked about art is not really an issue. But let us not forget what a powerful commodity beauty is.
Yeah.
And it will really transport something.
So we all know it's in the Louvre. Who owns it?
Well, it's the French government.
The French own it, yeah. I'm just looking at all these great... I've just got them up on my computer here looking at all the great pieces of art, like The Last Supper. I don't even know where that's housed. I know it. Everyone knows it. Where is that? Who owns
Milan.
That one?
It's a mural.
And owned by the Italians, is it?
Oh, it will be, yeah. And once art is in... Once the government is aware of works of art, they never let them go.
Right.
As well, so they never. But that's on a wall. You won't be able to get it off. You'd have to pull down the wall if you're going to get that. But, So a lot of the great works of art would never leave the countries from where they are presently housed.
Two quick things for you, because I know we're going to run out of time soon. First thing is theft. You always hear it. We love it, don't we? The great art. So many movies have been about. If these people do steal art, and they do every now and then, don't they? They come in and they take a picture off the wall or do something like that. Who the hell do they sell it to? Because obviously people like you are really aware of all the art knocking around.
I mean, I think the value of them turns out to be about 5% of the market price, and they're used as collateral in international crime deals. Drugs and what have you is I think the theory about that.
Right.
And they're not that many of them, really great works of art locked in basements, but they seem to change hands from those who I've spoken to, who've got insights into these activities. More on the detective side than the protagonists themselves, but they say that's approximately valued at 5%. So if you've got the Mona Lisa and it's worth five billion, work out what 5% of that is, and you could use that as a trading tool in your deal.
Right.
But can never see the light of day, and it goes from one basement from another, and you can imagine these sort of rather dark sepulchral figures looking at it and rubbing their hands and say, I own it.
Yeah, talking about that, I said earlier, one of my friends is an art dealer. In his spare time, he works in TV and stuff as well, and his dad was an art dealer, so he just couldn't resist it, and his houses are just full of art, which he can't resist collecting and stuff like that. But when I was there with him one day, he got a phone call, and he said, come over, bring it round. A bloke turns up on a scooter. I mentioned this when you came on my TV show. He's got a bin liner, and in it he's got these prints and their sketches, and I can't remember who they were from now. And he's going, what do you think? And he's putting a price on them and stuff. And I just thought, this is absolutely amazing. There's people driving around London trying to flog pieces of art to people. Is this a regular occurrence? This happens.
I don't know. That's a new one to me. But why not? I mean, and it's that great. You know, I love that idea. Right. Like it's a takeaway pizza.
And the final question I have for you, another friend of mine, I like speaking about art, I know nothing about it, but I like speaking about it. He bought a load of Indian art, and he bought it because he said it's an investment for his children, because Indian art, he says, retains its value. Eventually, I spoke to him last night, said, have you still got the Indian art? He goes, no, I sold it because it went up in value so much. But is that a case that, because we all look at this sort of Italian and French and all that sort of stuff, does the Indian and the Chinese art...
Definitely. If you can get any 18th century royal china from ceramics from China, they're the things that can make 30, 40, 50 million pounds.
Yeah.
I mean, yes. And... the first thing that the Chinese, who are, I think, the next major operators in the buying market for art, the first thing that they looked at was their own art, and right. that's why it's been pushed up. But what I've learned is, and I learned this actually on the Antiques Roadshow because of a terrible mistake I made, always ask someone what they know about a painting. Even if you're an art dealer, you think you know what you're talking about, always ask them what they know about it before you start launching in. And there was a woman once on the Antiques Roadshow who brought a picture of a little girl, and this was in Sudbury in Suffolk, and I was just getting going, and I was feeling overly confident. And I said, well, that's worth £2,000 to £3,000. It's by an artist called Henry Lamb, who was working in the sort of 30s and 40s, came from New Zealand. I said, this portrait of a little child would be worth more if it was slightly better looking, because she had a sort of scowling face, very well painted scowling face. I said, what can you tell me about it? Yep, she said, it's a portrait of me as a child. She was an old lady.
I have questions that I ask everybody, and the second question was, what's the biggest mistake you've made? Is that it, do you think?
The biggest mistake I made when I was at university, I was on a moped. I used to go around the place looking at country sales, trying to buy things, and I got to know a dealer in Norwich who had a whole load of works on his wall, which had labels under them that said Sir Alfred Munnings, who was the great horse painter of the late 19th, early 20th century. And I thought I'd found a real cache of them. And I spoke to my brother, who was an art dealer at the time in London, and still is, actually, and said, look, listen, I think I found something really exciting. He said, well, look, bring them up to London. So I hired a car. It was snowing. I went along the A11. And I remember arriving in London. It was getting dark. And a great friend of his, and a friend of mine still, an art dealer called Jonathan Clark, who we call Twister in the trade, Twister Clark. And which has nothing to do with his operational ethics. It's just because we like calling him Twister. And he knew a Munnings when he saw it. And he looked through the window of the car, and I was knackered, having sort of driven. And I only just got my driving test. And he looked in the back and went, fake, 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 fake. I managed to take 6 fakes up to London. I then drove back, dropped them off with the dealer, who had a sort of slightly inscrutable glint in his eye. He's dead now. His name is Cyril Paston. And 4 months ago, I was Googling that name, Cyril Paston. Uh-huh. And there was an American dealer saying, we have some genuine works by that amazing artist, Cyril Paston, who could recreate the style of any artist that was asked of him. And I've outed, 35 years down the line, I've outed the fact that he was the actual faker. He was a small chap, rather shrew-like, and he was damn well painting them.
All right, what one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Oh gosh, you know, I don't feel I'm really entitled to give advice, but if I was going to give it, it would be just to take risks. Actually, well, in whatever job you're in, just take risks, just push the boundaries, and then things happen. And if you can't walk up the front staircase, you can't get that way. You know, find a way of shinning up the drainpipe. You know, just push that little bit more, and things happen, marvelous happen. And fortune favours the prepared mind. If you're hungry, you'll find things.
Yeah, good advice. Any life hacks, maybe travel tips or something like that?
Well, travel tips. So one of my friends and clients is the guy who owns and runs DAF Trucks. His name is Mark Piggott. In fact, he used to tell me that every third lorry we see on the road is made by him, made by his companies. He's a fantastic. He's a sort of industrial colossus in America, and is a tremendous philanthropist. He's an English. He's been knighted actually for his services to England, even though he can't be a knight in America. You know, he's one of those honorary knights.
Yeah.
And he sort of spent his whole life on an aeroplane. And I get very agitated before I travel. I always think I've forgotten things. My wife is the same. We end up in a sort of a stew of anxiety. But he's said to me that you only need to worry whenever you travel. Yes, you will forget. You only need to worry, and yes, you will forget things. But you only need to worry about your passport and a piece of plastic to buy something to get out of trouble. And okay, it sounds rather sort of boring advice. It's actually, you know, it's been transformative.
Brilliant.
It's just two things.
That's great advice.
And if you get, because I'm always forgetting things, and I just know that I can always get out of trouble.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And also, if you travel lightly, it's a really nice way of going eventually if you do that. Mm. Okay, is there a book you recommend?
Yes. I'm deeply attached to nature. I was been a chair of a thing called Plant Life, the Wild Plant Conservation Charity, meadows and things like that. I'm really attached to that area. I have a meadow of my own. I'm engendering the wildflowers in it. And the most beautiful book, which is sort of liquid poetry, but it's also a brilliant book about nature. It's called Meadowland, and it's just about one field. It's by John Lewis Stemple. And I hope to meet him, actually. I've sent him a Twitter message saying, I'd just love to meet you. And he said he will come and meet me. And John has written this book about a field on his farm. And I would never have thought that one field could produce such a rich narrative. And you just want to be in that field by the end. It's as epic as a Greek tragedy. Not Greek tragedy. It's as epic as a Russian plot. A novel plot.
I'm just looking it up now. It's got amazing reviews on it. Meadowland. Okay, brilliant. I'll give that one a read. And finally, what is the meaning of life?
The meaning of life.
Just an easy one to end with.
Yeah, the meaning of life. Now, I worked out what the meaning of life was the other day, and I'm just trying to remember what it was. what did I say to you when we were driving along? This is Laurie, who's our... online manager. Positive attitude. So, positive attitude. A positive attitude is staggering. I know two or three people who have every reason to be bloody miserable, but they have this capacity to be able to see decency and optimism in every situation. And I've learned so much from watching them and watching how they cope with things. And frankly, if you've got the right spirit, you can handle anything. So it's a positive frame of mind. And I try myself. And funnily enough, stopping drinking helped me because I found that drinking was slightly affecting my mood. And that has allowed me to engender a little bit more of that positive spirit. So a positive approach to things. Always look for the good and never allow things to get you down. Damn difficult for people who are depressed. But even in a state of depression, look for something that's positive out of it and grab it.
Mm, it's not what happens to you. It's how you deal with it. Yeah. I'm really sorry about buying you wine.
No.
But can you re-gift it to someone?
Of course.
It's a nice bottle.
It's
there. Give it,
lovely.
No, give it to someone. No, give it absolutely. To someone who deserves it. I apologize. I'll do my research next time, and I didn't know that you didn't drink. So apologies.
No. I've got people who do.
Thank you so much for doing our podcast. I've just got to mention a few things where they can follow you. So follow you on Twitter at Philip Mould. Worth doing that, by the way, because you don't tweet that often. But when you do, it's insightful. It's very good. You can go to your website, which is philipmould.com. Is that right?
Yeah.
And this podcast, which I really recommend it because it's like a John Ronson podcast. A lot of my listeners will know that. It's like a documentary. It's beautiful. It's so right for this time of year. It's three episodes. It's all about Charles Dickens. I learned so much listening to that podcast, I've got to say, because I was coming into this interview thinking, what do I know about art? Nothing. The idea that art meets history, meets politics, it's all in your documentary. It's or your podcast, sorry. It's like a documentary style. It's very good. So do that. And I will put a link up to it. But where did you say the podcast was you have to go to?
You can get it on Entel.com.
Entel. How are you spelling Entel?
E-N-T-A-L-E.
E-N-T-A-I-L-E.
You can get it on iTunes.
Okay. iTunes. Oh, it's all on iTunes.
So you can see all the images coming up.
Saw that. Yeah. If you go to, and so the images come up as Philip talks you through all the process and stuff, you see it. Or it's tremendous. Honestly, I can't tell you how impressed I was by listening to that. So that's fantastic. Thank you so much for doing it. When's your next TV show, Zan?
So we started filming last week. Fiona lost her voice, so we had to stop filming. She sounded more and more like me. and that's coming out, I think, mid next summer.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Cheers. That was Philip Mould. Did you enjoy it, Mark?
I very much so.
Did you learn anything?
I did. I was interested to know how art was valued. There's a few things like that. I always thought, how it is valued, and also, who does own the Mona Lisa?
Yeah.
I never knew. You kind of guessed, but it's nice to kind of hear it.
I was always thinking that, because because the people often own stuff and then lend it into the museums, don't they? The way they value it, as it turns out, they Google it. I love that idea. How much is this worth? Google it. I don't know. Google or no?
Ask Jeeves.
That's how they're doing it. I like the stuff on Banksy. I think that's great. His theory on Banksy. I like all this conspiracy stuff on art. It works well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Banksy's I'm
quite cynical about things, like, for example, on a lesser level, things like, you know, when KFC apparently ran out of chicken, and you go, oh, come off it, that's such a great marketing thing. And the man-sized tissues recently.
Do you remember that?
The Kleenex will go, we're not doing man-size anymore because it's sort of non-PC.
Oh, really?
And you go, nice one, Kleenex, well done, perfect. And I hadn't seen through that one, and that's quite... I think I agree with him.
Very KLF.
Yes, yes.
Can we make more money by destroying money?
Yeah. There you go.
Destroy £1 million and make £6 million.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know whether they did or didn't, but there you go. I also quite liked his stuff on Saatchi as well. The idea that art, longevity of art, especially, I love the fact that he keeps saying how people are so enamored with art from the 20th century now.
Yes.
And it's how important that is. And I feel sorry for anyone who owns art, which is going down in value. You just always assume art just goes up in value.
Do you reckon he really liked Boy with Grenade?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yeah, because I walked in there and I watched his reaction. He went, wow, look at that. Right. And he went, well, that is brave, having that in your house.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it. I love that piece.
Yeah, I know, I know.
But I just...
I know, I do too. I was just wondering, because it's not his area.
No.
Because he said a couple of times, you know, I'm not a modern art expert.
I think he knows quite a bit about it, though.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And the thing I like most about it is saying about portals, because I've been worrying about I've been thinking...
You worry about everything,
as always, I've been overthinking and thinking, why have I got this stuff on my walls? What is it? What's the purpose of it? And now I love it. It's like a portal out there. And I'm just looking around at this art. I know a lot of it's sort of abstracty and modern, but it is that sort of... It's an image on the wall. It's like having a window, but if I had a window, I'd be looking at my neighbor's brick wall, or you know, or I'd be looking actually into my neighbor's house. But you know, it's now I can justify the art in my head. Yeah, and I know that's pathetic, but I don't know why.
Whatever gets you through the night.
But now I think, okay, I don't mind owning it now because it's good. So anyway, I thoroughly enjoyed that. Do you own any art, Mark? Are you going to buy any art?
No and no.
Wouldn't fancy owning some art?
No, I'd rather buy food.
Amazing. I love the word art, though, because sometimes when I'm doing Sunday brunch, the people sort of say, you know, chefs will talk about the art of cooking.
Yes.
Food, exactly. And you know for a fact any idiot can cook. Any idiot can cook a good meal, but to cook that meal to that Michelin star level takes real skill. But is it art? That's the thing. Is it art? And they like to say it is. And
I tend to agree.
Is it, I think so. The word art, what does it mean? Yeah.
No, exactly. I mean, if someone can put shit on a bed and call it art, I'm not being that sort of that guy.
Tabloid.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm saying, yeah. if that is art, then that can be art too. That can be.
When you're watching...
They can both be, when can't they?
All right, well, let me put this to you. When you're watching a young Tim Lovejoy try his stuff on television, you know, Soccer Am or Sunday Brunch, you're going, the way that is art. The way he's presenting that shot, it's artistic. He's an artist. Are you thinking that, Mark?
It looked... Yeah, no.
So what I do can't be called art.
It's a craft, and you make it look difficult.
I make it look a lot more difficult than it is. That is the art to TV.
It's a little, make it look difficult.
It's a little, it's a little secret everybody has. You know when people go, oh, God, it's so hard. I'll let you into a TV secret here. When everyone goes, it must be so hard having someone speak in your ear whilst you're talking. It really isn't. Honestly, it's so easy to do. It just takes a little bit.
See, I can't do it. You know, when I come around here and you've got the radio or the TV on and we're talking, I go, you've got to turn that off or I can't even listen to you. I can't have two things going on at once.
I wonder if it is easier or is I've just been doing a long time.
I think you've sort of created another channel into your brain.
Yeah, you do that. You do that. I had Van Tolkien, Tolkien's, the doctors on the other day, and they were getting me to do this sort of thumb finger thing on the show. You know, it's basically like patting your head and rubbing your stomach. If you do it long enough, you open up channels, you can do it. Like playing the guitar. No one can play the guitar to begin with, but opens up channels, and then you find it easy playing the piano. And I said, is that like me listening to someone in talking my ear while I'm talking to you? And they said, yeah, you'd have opened up something. So you're right. You are right, Mark. You could be a doctor. Dr. Mark. Fantastic. That's it for this week's show. You can. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to hear what you think about art. A lot of people sneer at art, don't they? You can email us at dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at Tim Lovejoy, or that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm done. I've got nothing else to say to you, Tim.
All right, we'll see you very soon. For the time being, peace and love, joy.
Bye.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key. And that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.